Welcome to the 65th episode of the Reading and Writing Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Rutherford. Stay tuned for my interview with Jay Bonansinga, author of many thriller and suspense novels, and Jay's latest novel is The Walking Dead, Rise of the Governor. Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Jay Bonansinga, the author of many thriller and suspense novels, including Shattered and Perfect Victim. Jay's latest novel is The Walking Dead, Rise of the Governor, a collaboration with Robert Kirkman, the creator of The Walking Dead comic books and graphic novels. Jay, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Sure.
Well, or at least telephonically, be here electronically.
Exactly. Well, I wondered if you could start out by reading the first paragraph of The Walking Dead, Rise of the Governor.
Absolutely. Before I read it, I just want to say that I've been reading this here and there, and I've decided that the best way to read it is in what I'm thinking of as my Ashley Wilkes voice, because all this stuff happens in the South, and I love the South, and I think it's just... it, like, for some reason, in a weird way, it seems to fit. So,
okay, that sounds
good. Bear with me. Okay, here we go. Chapter 1. It occurs to Bind Blake as he huddles in the musty darkness, the terror constricting his chest, the pain throbbing in his knees. If only he possessed a second pair of hands, he could cover his own ears and maybe block out the noise of human heads being demolished. Sadly, the only hands Brian currently owns are busy right now, covering the tiny ears of a little girl in the closet next to him.
Okay, great. It's The Walking Dead, all right. a lot of people, when they see a novel like The Walking Dead, Rise of the Governor in the bookstore, they're not really aware of how media tie-in novels work in terms of book publishing and kind of behind the scenes. Some people might mistakenly think, oh, Jay decided to write a Walking Dead novel. And I was just curious, can you explain how this project came about for you?
Sure. Well, you know, it's ironic you say that because, you know, I've done tie-ins. I've done works for hire over the years. I've been at this racket for over 25 years. And, you know, I've done my share of them. And I thought when I first lucked into this, when I stumbled into this, like, you know, I feel like, you know, Winnie the Pooh stumbling into the honeypot. You know, my agent was like, well, yeah, they'll probably just give you a script and, you know, you'll do a novelization. And so I was like, okay, it sounds fabulous. I'm stoked. But then when I finally talked to Robert, I asked him, are you going to give me a script? He's like, no. That's not what this is at all. You know, he's like, this is, I don't remember his exact words, but they were sort of on the line of, this is, you know, a reimagining. This is a, you know, this is a backstory, original, completely fully fleshed out series of novels. And then I really started getting jazzed. and now it's become like, you know, Lord of the Rings. You know, we're in the middle of Two Towers right now. And it's like fabulous. So I just really knew the right person that knew the right person. You know, I really kind of knew somebody that knew somebody. And, you know, my buddy and agent in Hollywood, Andy Cohen, you know, is friends with Robert's producing partners. And, you know, they got us all together. And, you know, I've been writing horror for a long time, and I've even worked with George Romero, and I'm kind of a zombie guy anyway. So I'm hoping and thinking that may have had something to do with getting the gig.
Sure. And do you have a sense, not to be too, you know, not to pry too much, do you have a sense, were you kind of in the running with others, or was it just that connection?
That's a good question. I was in the running. There were like five other guys, and, you know, I was you know, certain I wasn't going to get it.
Sure.
The more I learned about it, I knew about the comic, you know, but I didn't know much about the TV show or how big this thing was going to be. I knew it was an Eisner Award-winning comic, and really that's our Bible. That's our sort of alpha and omega, is the comic. But, you know, I didn't know at the time when I was signing on to it, and there were other guys vying for it, but I, you know, the more I learned about it and the more of the issues of the comic book I, you know, brushed up on, the more I'm like, wow, I really want this. And,
yeah.
You know, so I really started to woo them, you know. So, you know, whatever it was.
That's great. And I'm curious, I mean, the title of the novel is The Rise of the Governor. Was it your decision to focus the novel on the governor? And I'm also wondering, for those listeners who may not be familiar with The Walking Dead, if you could just take a moment and try to describe the governor without giving away too many spoilers.
Right. Well, that's, you know, the central issue of the material is where it comes from and how it gets to me and how I flesh it out and you know, how Robert and I work together and how this process has been organically kind of shaping up to what it is. And it's all been great. The thing about the governor, you know, if anybody's familiar with the comic, or if you're not familiar with the comic, I would recommend going back and grabbing either, you know, some trade paperbacks or even the hardcovers are beautiful collector's items. You know, you can get a hardcover of, like, many issues, and there's about 7 hardcovers, so you get the entire comic series. But the first hardcover through the 3rd or 4th, Governor is what, you know, basically what I would call the main villain, the main heavy. He's just the most incredibly evil, messed up villain. And I think I even think he won an award, like an Eisner Award for, you know, Villain of the Year in 2009 or something. But anyway, you know, he just sort of, you know, the heroes of this survival saga, they just sort of run into his lair. They sort of stumble in his web, and he just tears, you know, he just like tears a hole in the comic. He just takes it up a notch.
Mm-hmm.
And so Robert Kirkman always thought it would be fascinating to like do a really fully fleshed out study, maybe in prose, you know, of where this guy came from, how he got this way, you know, what the, you know, the Armageddon had done to him, you know. And so, you know, then when I learned, and this is our process, Robert will give me an outline, you know, and when I learned that this outline was going to revolve around who the governor is and where he came from, I thought, oh my God. And I took a deep breath and I'm like, it just couldn't be a better gig. It just couldn't be a juicier assignment, you know. It's probably a little bit like, you know, Terry Brooks must have felt this way when George Lucas, you know, hired him to write about, you know, Anakin Skywalker or something. You know, that's how I felt, you know.
Sure.
I just was so jazzed about it.
I'm curious, circling back a moment to kind of the process. I'm curious, you know, if you don't mind talking. You said so. You got, you know, an outline from Robert Kirkman, and that's where you realized that it was going to focus on the governor. And
right.
How did the process work? Did you write a complete draft, or did you send the novel to him in chunks and no, if you did send it to him in chunks,
you're sort of reading my mail. I mean, I did send him chunks, and you know, it was just like a perfect process for me. I've been doing, you know, this. Like I said, I've been doing this for a while. I've been writing books. I've got 14 books, you know, in print, and many of them are horror, and some are thrillers, and some are suspense, and some are nonfiction. You know, and some I've even ghostwritten books and stuff. I'm really just a, you know, journeyman writer. And so I felt really comfortable, you know, working this way. It's like, I think it was like 75 page chunks or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the small inner circle would take a look and just, make sure that, you know, everything was going well. And you know, fortunately for me, everybody, you know, dug my writing. And, you know, and then there were fascinating little things, like Robert would go, you know, I love it. You know, it's really moving along. I really like where it's going, you know. But on page 73, that guy has a tattoo. And in the comic, you see him, you know, shirtless. You see him naked, you know, and there's no tattoos. So we gotta remove that tattoo. And there was a lot of little stuff like that for continuity, so that all these universes, all these venues, these mediums would stack up and would comment on each other and be continuous. And like you could enjoy the comic book and then, you know, side straddle over to the book and enjoy that, but everything would sort of jibe. And that was really a fascinating part of the
process. That's great. Well, yeah. over the last several years, zombies have really exploded in pop culture with comic books, novels, video games, movies, the television show of The Walking Dead. In your opinion, and I'm sure you've probably given this some thought, what is the appeal of zombies, or why is that?
Well, you know, I think, well, you know, being a George Romero fanatic, and actually having the really great fortune of even getting to know him a little bit and working with him and just falling in love with the guy. He's one of the coolest people I've ever met on this planet. And, I've always believed that he tapped into, you know, what the meaning of the zombie is in the 60s and 70s, which is different than what the zombie means to culture today and why it resonates today. But when Romero is working, in his early phase, you know, and he was making Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead, where the zombies sort of infest the shopping mall, and, you know, it was a thinly veiled, you know, metaphor for this out of control consumer society, you know, and just this disgusting, vulgar consumerism and mindless, you know, obeyance of, you know, advertising and stuff. It just resonated so perfectly in its day, you know, and the gore and the horrific aspect just added to it. It just enhanced, you know, the symbolism and stuff. That's my perspective. I would never say that to George, though. He's such like a humble guy, you know, just a lovable, you know, ex-hippie.
Right.
And you just like do whatever, you know. If you see that, then that's fantastic. It's whatever works. You know?
That's great.
I'm you know, rambling a little bit, but just to focus on your question. But today, you know, my I'm convinced today the zombie is taking over as the horror icon of the moment. You know, for a while it was vampires and Twilight, and you know. And the vampire is obviously a sexual, psychosexual metaphor, psychosexual icon, you know, burgeoning sexuality, you know, repression. It came out of the Victorian era. You know, it was invented at the turn of the century when everybody was repressed and, you know, keeping their sexual urges, like, pent up. And that's a completely different metaphor. Today, the zombie, to me, is so beautiful and it resonates so powerfully. It's because of the hideous times we're living in, because of mortgages being underwater and you know, people getting foreclosed on and you know, nobody trusting anybody anymore and you know, it's like these are sort of blunt instrument problems that you can't move. You're stuck in your home, you know, and every morning, no matter how much, you know, Valium you take the night before, you wake up and there's that moldering, putrid problem again coming at you. You know, and no matter how many, you know, how many of them you kill by shooting them in the head, there's just millions more coming, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, for some reason, I really think it's the zombie is speaking to our times in a weird way. And that's why The Walking Dead, among all the zombie incarnations and iterations and movies and, you know, media and comics, Walking Dead is most powerful because it's these, you know, very three-dimensional or fascinating, flawed heroes struggling to survive, to try to get out from under it. You know, and I think that's, people feel like that right now. That's what the world looks like to people.
Sure. Sure. I think you're right, unfortunately, for a lot of people. And I think you're definitely on to something. To shift gears for a moment, I know that you've written, you know, as you've mentioned, 25 novels, and your own suspense and thriller and horror novels, prior to writing Rise of the Governor. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how you first got interested in writing. What was that kind of initial drive to write your first novel and try to get it published?
Well, like many writers, or well, I don't know if many, it's true, but like a lot of writers, I started out as a kid just copying things. I remember I wrote an entire book when I was like 12 years old that was, because at the time I loved a writer who was known as Trevanian. He wrote, you know, thrillers. He wrote like the Iger Sanction, and, you know, he had these like super, you know, brilliant, sexy spies, you know, like the very James Bond, very, you know.
Sure. I'm familiar with him. I actually interviewed Don Winslow, who wrote a Trevanian novel, if I'm not mistaken, about a year ago.
Yeah, that's cool. That's fantastic. Yeah, he was, I guess he was an advertising executive. You know, I can't remember his real name, but so I just wrote my own Trevanian novel. I still have it somewhere. It's hilarious. but you know, I'd done that. I've actually typed a novel that I've loved. I've actually just typed it to feel what it feels like, you know, to type a great novel, you know. But I wanted to do it for so long. It's hard to even remember back when I didn't want to be a writer, and I also wanted to be involved in horror my whole life, because, you know, I'm 52. I was born in 1959,
mm-hmm.
and I grew up. I was weaned on Rod Serling. I remember I used to watch Rod Serling, you know, host the show, Twilight Zone, and I'd see this cool guy in this black mortician suit with the thin lapels and skinny tie with a cigarette, you know, addressing the camera. And I thought when I was, you know, 11 years old, like he was the coolest guy I've ever seen. And then I found out he wrote the stuff, you know, and I'm like, oh man, I got to do that. I got to be that guy. And I got to write, you know? And so that's, you know, I've wanted to do it ever since Rod Serling first appeared on TV.
And so what was that process like for you to sit down and actually, you know, as you said, kind of type out and copy a novel that had already been published? Did you feel that was something that you needed to do to kind of to see how it was done in effect, or what was that like for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I recommend it to anyone who's serious about writing or any art for that matter. You know, I know a lot of musicians. I have, my family's just full of musicians. I come from music, you know, musical family. And, they do the same thing with, you know, like a Charlie Parker solo or, you know, the score for some great piece of music, and they just, you know, learn it backwards and forwards. And they'll, you know, and it starts when you're a kid, when, you know, you listen to the, you know, Jimi Hendrix, you know, solo, and, you know, and then you just replicate it note for note, you know, over the course of weeks and months, just meticulously. And it's like a really beautiful exercise. It's almost necessary. I mean, I teach creative writing now and again at Northwestern and DePaul University, and I often, you know, see there are two categories of student. There's the fan, and then there's the student who's just basically getting credits, you know, and is not really as interested in the field of writing. But the fan, in my experience, the person who loves it and is a fan and would be reading this stuff, you know, no matter what, and probably would be writing if they were dropped on a desert island and they had no hope of any publication or sales, but they would still just be writing. But, you know, they're the ones who succeed and do really well. You know, it does come from a love. You know, Stephen King is probably one of the biggest fans of horror. He reads everything, mm-hmm. you know, and he's just like a big kid. And I think that's where his genius lies.
Sure. Well, I know from research that in addition to writing novels that you produced and directed a film, Stash, and you've done script yeah. writing. I know that writing novels is entirely different from working on a film, which is an extremely collaborative art form. I wonder if you could talk right. about the differences. What appeals to you about novels and what appeals to you about working in film?
Well, you know, it's funny because it's not as different as you might think. I agree that, you know, on the surface, there are two different mediums in there, and one is very collaborative and the other one is solitary, and one costs a lot of money to create the product, you know, the end product, and the other one is fairly inexpensive. Publishing's getting even more and more inexpensive because of the digital, you know, book world.
Right.
But so is film. Film is going the same way that publishing is going. It's film's sure. getting cheaper and faster and just as, and it's great. It's great. I'm of the opinion that it's all really good for the art. It's good for the mediums of both, you know, film and prose. But at the end of the day, the differences aren't as, you know, profuse as you would think, because especially if you're a writer-director. Because, you know, I took, like for Stash, for instance, I took a short story, a horror story, really a twisted one, probably one of the most bizarre things I've ever written. It was published in Cemetery Dance, and then it was reprinted here and there. And I got a lot of mail on it, you know, and I took that and I thought, okay, this is the perfect controversial cult indie film. You know, it's like the same, it's like the same instincts, the same impulses that got me to write it in the first place were present when I was adapting it and raising the money for it. And, it worked out beautifully. I mean, it seemed to live in that other medium, and I think I used the same toolkit, you know, when I was directing it, just the storytelling, you know, basic storytelling toolkit. And I have big arguments with academics about it, you know, because everybody wants to sort of compartmentalize this stuff.
Right.
But I tell my students, you know, really, you're talking about telling a story, and you're going to either be doing it with images, or you're going to be doing it, you know, with prose, but the structure is the same. You know, there's a beginning, middle, and end. And it's more similar than you would think.
Gotcha. Well, I read about a book that you wrote and was published, Pinkerton's War. I wasn't clear if the book was narrative nonfiction or if it was a historical novel.
It's narrative nonfiction. You know, some people call it creative nonfiction, but, you know, that sounds like it's a bunch of lies. I got 75 pages of endnotes. That was the challenge on Pinkerton's War, is that, you know, I discovered this story that, you know, sounds like a suspense film. It sounds like a, you know, just an amazing movie that you would see, and it's all true. It has to do with this guy, Alan Pinkerton, who, you know, essentially was our first inner-city undercover detective in the 1850s in Chicago. Mm-hmm. But he became instrumental, and he entered the world stage when he accidentally, almost stumbling upon this massive conspiracy and insurgent plot to assassinate Abraham Lincoln on the way to his first inauguration. And it was all set that it was going to happen in Baltimore, and the conspirators were highly organized, and it was a real threat. And Pinkerton uncovered it, and he convinced Lincoln to sneak into Washington using a series of, like, midnight trains and underground trains, and Lincoln traveled in disguise, and it's really this amazing story. And then eventually Pinkerton, who saves Lincoln's life in that early in those early years, was asked to come to Washington and create what now is known as the Secret Service.
That's interesting. I think a lot of people are not aware of that part of history.
Yeah, I know. That's why I really, that was sort of my impetus behind, you know, and that's what really got me jazzed about it, was that it was sort of a hidden piece of history, arcane part of history, not a lot of people knew about. I mean, I even took this, I talked to Civil War scholars, and they were like, really? Pinkerton did that? What year was that? Oh, I did not know that. And I was like, wow, this stuff is really under, you know, exposed in the body of literature. Not that there's anything on Abraham Lincoln that's not completely, you know, explored on from every different angle. But this, I think this is an Abraham Lincoln side note that not a lot of books have been written about.
Interesting. Are there other historical books that you would like to write?
That and the fact that Abraham Lincoln was a vampire hunter, but that's a completely different story. I'm sorry.
I think that one's been written.
Yeah, right. You're right. That already. Yeah, even that's been written.
Yeah, exactly. Who are some of the writers that inspire you and that you enjoy reading when you're not writing?
Bradbury, you know, when I was a kid, Ray Bradbury, he's probably the first writer that really sunk a hook into me and you know, showed me literature, modern literature, not just pulp, because I love pulp and I've read pulp all my life. And, you know, my mom and grandma were big fans of James Cain and, you know, Betty Davis movies, and they warped me. Even when I was like, you know, 8 years old, they would let me stay up and, you know, watch black and white and noir films. And I love that, and that's part of my background. But Bradbury was really the first true influence, and, you know, I carried around Ars for Rocket in my pocket and was inseparable with it and reread it many times. And I'm actually really delighted and touched that I've been asked to contribute to a book based on Bradbury. Margaret Atwood is in it, and it's just like this, you know, Dean Koontz, and just this huge honor roll of fantasists and major writers. And
what book is that?
It's called Bradbury Lives, and it's the works of works. It's got a long title.
Okay.
Something like, I don't have it in front of me, but it's something like, it's an anthology, and it's called Bradbury Lives, works dedicated, inspired by the works of Ray Bradbury, stories inspired by the works of Ray Bradbury, or something like that. I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me.
That's okay. But, and is that published now, or is that upcoming?
It's upcoming. It comes out next year.
Okay.
And we're going to have a big release on at Comic-Con next year, and I'm really excited about that. And that was one of my huge influences. And then also Harlan Ellison is another writer who not only was an influence when I was a kid, and, you know, I read his masterworks, you know, when I was, you know, teenager.
Mm-hmm.
But then I got a chance to meet him, and he became a mentor.
Wow.
In fact, the first time I met him, I wrote this book called The Black Mariah in 1994, and Romero signed on to direct it. New Line picked it up, and it was a great experience, even though it never got made into a movie.
Sure.
But I worked with Romero on it and got to meet George, and it was a great experience. And so then the following summer, I'm out on the road doing signings and stuff, and this was my first book. So I'm at, Comic-Con, and I'm sitting at the table, you know, with some other authors, and all of a sudden, I see this little dynamo of a guy, like a scarf, you know, and a beret, and it's Harlan Ellison, and he's coming towards me. I'm like, it's Harlan Ellison, and he comes over to our table, and he looks at us, and he sees my name, you know, and I'm like, it's great to meet you, Harlan. I'm Jay Bonenstein, and he goes, oh yeah. I know this book. I read it. I'm like, excuse me? And he goes, yeah, I read it. yeah, it was good. I'm like, oh my God, seriously, you, Harmon Ellison, you think my, I'm, you know, and so I'm like making an idiot of myself and being like a fanboy and everything. And Ellison, he's so jaded and used to this stuff. And finally, you know, he lets me go on and on for a minute, and then he looks at me and goes, look, I said it was good. It's not Les Miserables.
That's great that you have a Harlan Ellison story.
Yeah. And so, I loved him from that moment on. There was something about that that was so honest and sort of, you know, Harlan-esque.
Yeah, exactly. Well, when you talk to aspiring writers, what advice do you give them for pursuing their own writing and trying to get published?
Well, I think I've mentioned one of the main things that I urge people to do, which is read. You know, become, if you're not like a huge fan now, you know, become one. Just absorb as much of it as you can. And I advise younger writers and fledgling writers, don't treat it as a precious thing. Don't treat it as a finely buffed jewel that you take out of your drawer every once in a while to show the select few. And if somebody even looks at it askance, you're offended. Don't treat it like that. Treat it like a job. Treat it like a profession. You know, be a professional. You know, get your stuff out there and get dirty and rewrite it and you know, get it in front of people that, you know, don't care about you and don't know your name. You're just a number, you know, and just, you know, get out there and, you know, basically be professional about it. You know, because I think that's actually, in an odd way, that's where the art really starts to emerge, when you're calloused and tough, and you know what you believe in, and you know when it's working. You know, you develop that. That's a rhino skin, you know, tool. You know, and so that's, you know, and as I said, you know, the ones that are fans, those are usually the people who go on and have careers. The people who are fans, who are talented enough to be professionals. If you can be a fan and a professional, that by the way, incidentally, that defines who Robert Kirkman is. You know, he's the ultimate fan of this stuff, who is just, you know, happens to be almost by coincidence extremely talented and brilliant, you know. But he began as a fan of this stuff, and he loves comics, and he knows them inside and out, and, you know, he lives and eats and breathes them, and that's why I believe he's, you know, he's Robert Kirkman, you know. And so, you know, that's just, I think that's something you can actually willfully do. You can say, well, I'm going to just read the classics, and you know, totally believe in that.
Great. Well, what are you working on now?
Well, as I said, I'm just embarking on what I think of as our two towers, our middle book, The Walking Dead series. And also to continue warping the Peter Jackson metaphor, we might even work on these next two books all in like one epic, you know, work session over the next year. You know, I'm hoping that I can work on both books 2 and 3, because these, without spoiling anything, I'll give you a little nugget. These three books, this trilogy of novels that are original novels that began with The Rise of the Governor, they are going to form like an epic piece of, you know, storytelling. I can't tell you how they're connected, but I can sort of give you that hint that they are going to be an epic set. The people are going to want to have the three, and that's not just a commercial.
That's great.
And that's about all I can say right now.
Yeah, sure. I understand. I look forward to reading those as they come out. Where can people find more information about you and your books online?
Well, thanks for asking. And a good place to go is www.jbonansinga.com. That's got a lot of know, links, news, and it's got my blog, and but also lately there's a lot of Facebook pages that are really fun to visit. Like there's the Walking Dead Facebook page, which is run by St. Martin's, and that's a lot of fun because Robert's on there a lot, and I go on it and we comment, and the fans talk, you know, have dialogues and stuff, and I highly recommend that one. That's a really cool, you know, place to go. And also, if you're interested in seeing, you know, an elongated kind of preview sampling of Stash, my film, there's a website, www.stashmovie.com, or the Facebook page for Stash, and you might get a kick out of that.
That's great. And is that available on DVD, or how can someone watch that?
Yeah, it's available on DVD. It's available, you know, in all the usual suspects, Netflix, Amazon, you know, it's available at the distributor's site, which is Singa Entertainment, S-I-N-G-A, entertainment.com. There's a cat, and I think it's on sale. I mean, you can get it like a $14.99 down to $9.99 or something on that site.
Okay.
And yeah.
Great.
It stars Marilyn Chambers in her last film before she sadly passed away.
Well, thanks. Again, we've been speaking with Jay Bonansinga, co-author of the new book, The Walking Dead, Rise of the Governor, available in bookstores now. And Jay, thanks for doing the interview.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to my latest podcast. If you have a chance, please leave a review of the podcast in iTunes. It only takes a moment. Until next time, read some good books and be well.